From Cherokee to Currituck, from the largest city to the smallest town, and from the state house to the schoolhouse, it's Carolina Journal Radio, your weekly news magazine discussing North Carolina's most important public policy events and issues.
Welcome to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokheim. During the next hour, Donna Martinez and I will explore some major issues affecting our state. Members of the North Carolina General Assembly tend to be a bit older than the population at large. You'll learn why some younger lawmakers have decided to create a new group. It's called the North Carolina Future Caucus. This state has one of the nation's strictest laws limiting access to the statewide election ballot. But you'll learn about efforts to loosen those ballot restrictions for the future. Agriculture still means big business in North Carolina. You'll hear from one of the General Assembly's most vocal advocates for farming and for agribusiness. And we'll examine new research. It spells out traits that help determine whether a public school teacher will succeed in the classroom. Those topics are just ahead. First, Donna Martinez joins us with the Carolina Journal headline.
State legislators have gone home, for now, that is. They have passed a new state budget and dozens of other bills, some of which remain on Governor Cooper's desk, some of which have actually been vetoed by the governor. But legislators won't be gone for too long. In fact, in about 3 weeks or so, they will return to Raleigh. Carolina Journal Editor-in-Chief Rick Henderson is here to explain why they're coming back. Rick, welcome back.
Thanks, Donna.
That was pretty quick recess for them, right?
Yes.
About a month or so. Why are they returning?
They are allowing themselves a little more than the 30-day period that the Constitution allows for the governor to decide if he wants to sign veto bills or let them become law without his signature. So they take a 33-day recess after June 30th, and then they're coming back, and they're taking another 30-some-day recess before September. So they're basically covering their bases so that they can decide when they're coming back rather than the governor.
So there is a definite method to their madness, so
yes,
to speak.
Yes, there is. They could have gone ahead and adjourned for the year and set a return date of sometime in the spring. But if they had done that, then Governor Cooper could have called them back whenever he wanted to, for instance, if there was something going on for overrides or things like that.
So we know that Governor Cooper has vetoed a number of bills so far, about half a dozen or so.
Right.
There have been quick overrides of his vetoes. So is the legislature anticipating that among the 100 or so bills that are currently on the governor's desk that there are some vetoes to come?
That's possible. He vetoed a bill dealing with aerosol leachate spray, or the so-called pig juice that's used to clean out some waste lagoons. And that bill was vetoed. The override may take place on the 3rd. They may schedule a vote, or they may decide they don't have enough votes to override it. There are a few others that are out there pending. A campus free speech bill, which Carolina Journal has written about somewhat extensively, that was not supported by the UNC system, but that did receive majority votes in General Assembly. And also there's an energy bill that includes several provisions. This was the big stakeholder bill in which everybody was involved in the process, except the ratepayers, of course.
But stakeholders, also known as special interests.
Yes,
right?
That's right. And that bill, the way that it was pitched by the stakeholders was that it was like a great big Jenga tower, and if you attempted to remove one piece, the whole thing could collapse. Well, the General Assembly actually added some pieces to the Jenga tower, including a temporary moratorium on new wind farms. And so that may be something that would lead the governor to veto the bill, and it's unclear if that would be overridden. Also.
So when they come back on August 3rd, they could have several different things that they may need to address. And
right.
We know that in the legislature, the Republicans have super majorities, but that's not really a lock on some of these issues that they would be able to quickly override.
That's true. So in some cases, you're going to have a fairly solid Democratic caucus, but you may have some Republicans who will join along. The bill, the energy bill, for instance, was opposed by almost all the environmental groups, and a relatively influential Republican legislator, Representative Chuck McGrady, out of Henderson County, has said that he certainly opposes that bill. And so if this comes back up, then it's always possible that some of these vetoes would not be overridden.
Rick, would they also potentially address any other pieces of legislation that they consider to be unfinished business?
Right. Yes, there were at least a half dozen or more bills that were in conference at the time that they left town. Some of those were conference committees that were appointed, or at least the conferees were ready to be appointed when they left. They hadn't even appointed the conferees yet. So there are some bills that passed one chamber and didn't pass the other, or they passed one and the other one didn't concur with the version. And so there are some, again, that may be taken up, and that's one of the options that they have during the special session.
Also on the docket, potentially at least, is this very interesting story that came out the last couple of weeks of the session, really. Representative Chris Millis was the person behind this, a potential impeachment proceeding against Secretary of State Elaine Marshall.
Right. Back in the spring, Representative Millis had made a request of the Secretary of State for all the records of notaries public that had been authorized over a period of several years. And when he got those documents back, he said that there were something in the neighborhood of 300 of those that were issued to people who had submitted documents that were not allowed to be considered for people to become notaries public. Now, there was a presentation before the legislature about this at the time. Representative Millis said if Elaine Marshall does not resign, he would pursue impeachment proceedings against her, and a resolution was introduced to set up a formal select House committee. Now, Secretary of State Marshall's office has responded by saying that when a person applies to be a notary public, there are only certain forms that are accepted, and those are the ones that are allowed to prove legal residency in North Carolina. And the documents that she accepts would be things like birth certificates or green cards. She said her representative there said quite often people will send a whole lot of documents that may include things that aren't on the list. And so the assertion was that these documents that Representative Millis found may have been one of a bundle of documents that were sent, but that the actual documents that proved the person was eligible to be a notary and was a legal resident of North Carolina and of the United States, that those situations were satisfied. But Representative Millis is still pursuing this.
So do I have it right then that at the August 3rd session, what the legislature would look at is a resolution saying, yes, we want to look into this?
That's the way it stands right now. Or there could be something else introduced at that time. They may say we'll appoint an independent counsel to investigate it or something like that.
Or they could say no.
They could say that they're not interested in doing so. That's right. They could absolutely decide that they're satisfied that doesn't look like that Secretary of State Marshall has done anything wrong.
So that's the August 3rd session. But then, Rick, we also know that the legislature has plans, as you mentioned a few minutes ago, to come back again, this time after Labor Day.
Right. And the September session is, again, to allow for things that might have happened in the August session. So, for instance, if they
this
decide –
this never ends is the moral of the story.
That's right. Well, yeah, that's right. What they could do is they could take some of these bills that are in conference, pass them, send them to the governor, who may then veto them, and then they would have to have an override session. So that may be part of what happens. They may also do some work on redistricting, although the talk right now is that it's probably going to wait until November before they finish that up. But they're awaiting instructions from the federal court to see exactly what they're supposed to look for when they draw new districts. New districts are going to have to be drawn before the 2018 elections for both legislature and Congress, but they're still awaiting the court to say exactly what do we want to look for so that we make sure that we draw districts that are constitutional.
Because it seems like the definition of constitutional is a moving target.
Yes. General Assembly has always said we did not gerrymander based on race. We gerrymandered based on partisan affiliation, that we wanted to make sure that we could get as many Republicans elected as possible to
which
the General
legal.
Assembly, which is legal. And the courts have been – the federal courts have not exactly been as clear about that as they used to be. There was some questions raised about whether or not partisan gerrymandering was okay. And so now what we're dealing with is a court that's trying to define something without setting any bright lines. And so the General Assembly is a little bit confused about that, as many of us are.
So the General Assembly will be back on August 3rd, and then again after Labor Day, and then this issue of the maps and these court rulings.
That's correct.
Rick Henderson is editor-in-chief of Carolina Journal. You can follow him on Twitter.
At Deregulator.
All right, Rick, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more Carolina Journal Radio to come in just a moment.
Government plays a key role in your life, affecting your paycheck, the way you educate your kids, the way you do business. How can you tell if government is doing a good job, making the right choices, spending tax dollars wisely? CarolinaJournal.com tackles those questions every day. The John Locke Foundation publishes Carolina Journal in print each month and on the web each day at CarolinaJournal.com. You'll find exclusive investigative reports on topics no one else is covering. What else? A rundown of the best news stories, editorials, and opinion columns in North Carolina. John Hood's Daily Journal. News stories and important public events at CarolinaJournal.tv. And the voices of the newsmakers themselves at Carolina Journal Radio. In print, on the air, and on the web, you can find the information you need at CarolinaJournal.com. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Members of the North Carolina General Assembly tend to be older than the state's population in general, but there are members who are 45 and younger. Now they're joining forces on both sides of the partisan divide for a new group. It's called the North Carolina Future Caucus. Democratic State Representative Chaz Beasley of Mecklenburg County explains.
This is a caucus that's been created in a few other states, about 20 across the country. And it's geared toward members of the General Assembly who are under the age of 45. And basically our goal is to make sure that people who are on the younger side of the spectrum when it comes to what's going on here in the General Assembly, not only are representative, but can get together in a bipartisan fashion and make sure that we're talking about issues that affect the future of our state. As we know, it's critical in this current time that we have more bipartisanship and that we're willing to work across the aisle. And we also know that it is tremendously important that people who are going to be the future of our state feel like they have ownership in what we're doing.
Republican Representative Kyle Hall will help Beasley lead the new group.
Most of the things that we do at the General Assembly tend to be bipartisan in nature anyway. If you look at our voting records of everybody that's here that's an elected official, probably about 80% of what we vote on ends up getting a vote of 120 to nothing in the House and probably 50 to nothing in the Senate. There's only about 20% of the time that we actually disagree. And I think that one good thing about this caucus that we have established here is giving us that open dialogue. Chaz Beasley and I don't necessarily agree on every single issue that's in the General Assembly. As a conservative, I believe that our millennial generation expects to have the same promise that was envisioned to us by our founding fathers, which is life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I believe that our millennials, the one issue that they're most concerned about in the future is the prospects of having a job. And that's the number one focus that we need to have in this caucus, is to make sure that North Carolina continues to grow stronger each and every day. And those are the issues that I will fight for on this caucus.
Democratic Senator Jay Chaudhry of Wake County helped put the new caucus together.
I'm excited about helping be a part of establishing this caucus. Now, I will confess to you that I am not a millennial. I am a member of the Gen X generation, but there is a reason that I have a vested interest in making sure that we established the North Carolina Future Caucus. There are two reasons. First, there's the obvious demographic changes in North Carolina. Millennials are rapidly growing in the state. In this year, millennials will outnumber baby boomers for the first time, becoming the largest adult population, adult generation in North Carolina. And today, millennials constitute one out of every four voters in North Carolina. In a study that was done last year, Wake County was considered one of the top 10 national markets for millennial home buyers. And in my district, which is home to North Carolina State University, Peace College, and Meredith College, obviously there are many, many millennials that are here in the district. And second, reason that I thought it was important that we establish this caucus, that it is important that we come together to take on challenges facing the issues, confronting the issues that are important to our youngest citizens, citizens who will really define the course of the rest of the 21st century. And so I want to do whatever I can to make sure that we can proactively include the voices of millennials and have them be part of their conversation so that we can have a shared prosperity for this state today and a shared prosperity for this state in the future.
Stephen Olakara leads the Millennial Action Project, a Washington, D.C.-based group. He's working with the new North Carolina caucus.
We have been launching these future caucuses all across the country, building a bipartisan movement of young lawmakers who are saying something very simple, that the founding creed of this country is one where out of many, we become one. For all of our diversity, it's essential for the success of our democracy to be able to build consensus and common ground. But we're here today because we are confronted with a threat to our democracy, which is that partisan polarization is the worst it's been since the end of Reconstruction. And we have historic numbers of young people feeling disaffected from the political process. Indeed, a majority of millennials today do not believe that politics can solve the problems we face. Less than a third of millennials see public service as an appealing career track. But at the same time, we cannot forget the potential that this generation has to offer. We actually have the highest service participation rates in this country. And as we know, historically, great political transformation has been driven by young people.
You're listening to highlights from the public launch of a new group within the North Carolina General Assembly. It's called the North Carolina Future Caucus. Stephen Olakara of the Millennial Action Project points to two parts of the new group.
One aspect of it is we have serious challenges confronting young people that we have to address, whether it has to do with creating the economic opportunity, helping young people access education, dealing with the student debt crisis we have, being able to attract and retain young North Carolinians to the state. Today, we're actually not announcing an agenda, but these are the sorts of issues that caucuses across the country have worked on. And it's important for millennials, before they reengage with the process, to know that the process is actually working for them. But the second piece here is even deeper than any single piece of legislation. And that is, can the youngest legislators here be the adults in the room? Can they model the type of civil discourse that we need? Can they build bridges of cooperation and mutual understanding? There are a lot of areas, maybe 20%, where legislators won't agree, and there's disagreement there. But the power of this group is to say, we can work together on other issues, and we can disagree constructively. That's what we need here, without demonizing and vilifying the other side. Because the more we do that, the further we move apart as a country, the more we focus only on the short-term crises, and the less we can actually address the long-term challenges that we face as a country.
So what kinds of issues might this new future caucus discuss? Republican Representative Kyle Hall offered his suggestions.
Representative Beasley last week demonstrated part of that. One of those issues that he fought for in the budget last week was adding an amendment to the budget to require financial literacy to make sure that our young people are prepared for the future. But I think all in all, I think that we could come together, at least in my opinion, on some tax reform issues and some education issues to make sure that our classrooms are adequately funded, that our teachers are adequately paid for the challenges that they faced. I think also our public safety. I think that all of us up here understand that we have the same number of state troopers on the road today as we did in 1992. Obviously, North Carolina has grown tremendously since then, and I think that that's something that millennials should take very seriously.
Hall's Democratic counterpart, Chaz Beasley, chimed in with his own suggestions.
One of the things that is particularly an issue that you hear from just about every single millennial that you talk to is about student loan debt, about the fact that you have to basically take out a mortgage on your education in order to get an education. Those are the types of things that hopefully we can draw attention to, that we can come up with solutions for. Because so many people rightly or wrongly, do believe that a lot of young people are not represented in spaces like this adequately, and that does lead to disaffection. That does lead to people feeling like there's no place for them here.
You've been listening to highlights from a news conference launching a new group within the North Carolina General Assembly. It's dubbed the North Carolina Future Caucus. It's designed to bring together Republican and Democratic lawmakers who are 45 years old or younger. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you looking to make North Carolina more free? The John Locke Foundation is, and here are three things you can do today to help us make it happen. First, know the facts. Visit johnlocke.org for data, analysis, interviews, and more. And read carolinajournal.com to learn what government is doing with your money. Second, influence the debate. Invest in the John Locke Foundation's work with a tax-deductible donation. You can get it done in less than 90 seconds at johnlocke.org. And third, make North Carolina more free by sharing the message of freedom. It's easy when you visit johnlocke.org. Click on shareables, download, pass the messages of freedom to your friends, print the messages and mail them. Or if you're a savvy computer user, share the message of freedom on Facebook and Twitter. Know the facts, influence the debate, and share the message. Three things you can do today to help us make North Carolina more free. Get started today at johnlocke.org.
North Carolina is changing, not just day to day, but hour to hour, minute to minute, even second to second. How can you keep up with the changes, especially the ones that affect you, your family, your home, your job? Make the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal part of your social media diet. On Facebook, like the John Locke Foundation, like Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal. News, insights, and analysis you'll find nowhere else. Thanks to the experts at the John Locke Foundation, and thanks to the first-class investigative reporting of Carolina Journal. Don't wait for the morning newspaper. Don't wait for the evening news. If it's happening now, it's happening here. The John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal have you covered with up-to-the-second information. Like us on Facebook, the John Locke Foundation and Carolina Journal. Follow us on Twitter, at John Locke NC and at Carolina Journal.
Did you know you can now advance freedom and free markets just by shopping with Amazon? It's true. Online shopping is now a great way to support the John Locke Foundation. Just shop using the Amazon Smile program and designate us, the Locke Foundation, to receive a portion of your purchase amount. That's right. You shop and Amazon donates money to us, the John Locke Foundation. So here's how it works. Log on to smile.amazon.com. Amazon Smile, it's the same Amazon you know. Same products, same prices. But here's what's better. Amazon donates 0.5% of the price of your eligible purchases to us, the John Locke Foundation. So try it. Be sure to designate the Locke Foundation as the nonprofit you want to support. It's that easy. So now, not only will you enjoy what you buy, you'll also support freedom. Don't forget, log on to smile.amazon.com today. Buy something nice and help defend freedom. Help support the John Locke Foundation.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. It's tough for a new political party to gain access to North Carolina's election ballot. Republican State Senator Andrew Brock wants a change.
North Carolina had one of the most restrictive ordinances or laws on the books as far as allowing third-party access. This just lowers it, which makes it a little bit easier and comes in line with more states allowing third-party access.
Brock supports a bill to lower the number of petition signatures a new party needs to collect. The current standard is roughly 95,000. Brock's proposal, 10,000. State Representative John Hardister asked Brock why.
The threshold, the 10,000 threshold signatures, would you mind explaining how you arrived at that number?
We looked at some other states that are out there which that have less restrictive numbers than we do. And, you know, when you're looking at 93,000 and the way our states continue to grow, it's going to make it tougher and tougher for other parties to get involved and or actually other parties to start. And you're looking at obtaining 93,000 verified signatures of voters in different districts. And basically, you're going to keep the state under a complete two-party control. We're just trying to lower it, make it a little bit easier. They still have to be verified. They still have to do still be in at least three of the congressional districts.
State Representative Michael Speciale questions looser rules for unaffiliated candidates.
In theory, we're making it easier for people to get on the ballot.
Yes,
so we could have possibly, if enough people are interested, we could have, let's say, 10 unaffiliateds on the ballot. 10 people, since there's no primary for them, we would have a Republican, a Democrat, and 10 unaffiliateds in the general election.
Representative John Zoka asked about a provision to lower the number of congressional districts needed for a new party's petition signatures.
With lowering the number of qualified voters so much, I would have thought a good counter to that might be to have at least 200 signatures from each one of the 13 congressional districts as a counter to lowering the number so far. I'd like to know your logic on going from 200 signatures from four congressional districts to three congressional districts and not going the other way.
We just try to make it a little bit easier for people to get on the ballot.
State Libertarian Party Chairman Brian Irving supports reform.
This is an issue, access to the ballot, that Greens and Libertarians agree on. When you have people from different political perspectives, we have the Democracy NC and the John Locke Foundation also supporting ballot access reform. When you have an issue like that, then that tells you that the people, this is something the people want. Most states, 36 of our 50 states, have a lower requirement for getting third parties and independent candidates on the ballot. So North Carolina is number one as being the most restrictive.
You've been listening to debate about ballot access rules in North Carolina. We'll return with more Carolina Journal Radio in a moment.
Are you tired of fake news? Well, you won't find it here. At Carolina Journal, we don't make things up and we don't presume or assign motives. There's no simpler way to put it than that. We're proud to say that honest, factual, rigorous journalism is the Carolina Journal way. Our reporting team is focused on accountability in government and policymaking, no matter which political party is in power and regardless of the person taken to task in the story. At Carolina Journal, we're beholden to the truth and to transparency. Unlike fake news, lies, innuendo, questionable sourcing, all meant to create controversy, not inform the debate. So the next time you're confronted with fake news, log on to CarolinaJournal.com or pick up the latest print edition. You'll find compelling news reporting from a team that knows what it means to be real journalists, committed to truth. Carolina Journal, you can count on us for the facts.
Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Mitch Kokai. Agriculture has long served as one of the most important pieces of the North Carolina economy. And even as the state has changed, farming and industries related to farming continue to play an important role. One of the people who's been most vocal about the role of agriculture in North Carolina is our next guest. State Representative Jimmy Dixon is a farmer. He also chairs the State House's Agriculture Committee. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Mitch. It's my delight and pleasure to be with you this morning.
When we talk about agriculture, just how big a deal is it to North Carolina?
Well, obviously, everybody knows that is in touch with any degree of information that it is the largest segment of our economy, representing about $84 billion a year and approximately 600,000 jobs in North Carolina.
When you chat with people and share those numbers, are they surprised that at this day and time, agriculture is still the number one piece of the economy?
They really are to a great extent. And, of course, that is the produce that we produce, the animals that we produce, and including the agribusiness that's associated with the industry to come up with that $84 billion. And we believe, and Commissioner Troxler has set a goal for us to soon be at the $100 million level for the total input of agriculture in the state of North Carolina. Yes, most folks are surprised when we say that. They do not realize the degree to which we still depend upon that segment of our economy to carry the burden in North Carolina.
If people are surprised about that, I guess that would also probably lead to some of them not understanding the need to protect and promote agriculture in the economy. Is that right?
That is correct. And I'm glad you used two words there, Mitch. You used protect and promote. I'm a proponent to say that we need to promote. If we identify a protector for anything, you automatically have identified your destroyer if they want to do that.
Yeah, so in promotion, what are some of the things that you, as a member of the General Assembly who has a farming background and who chairs the Agriculture Committee, what are some of the things you want to see the state do to promote agriculture and agribusiness?
Well, let me just start off very simple and very elementary, and this will get a laugh or two because it sounds so ridiculous on its surface. One of my main jobs is to get folks in North Carolina to understand that food actually does not come from the grocery store.
I'm laughing, so you got one laugh anyway.
In my first session in the General Assembly in the Agriculture Committee, I made that statement, and I got some really inquisitive looks from some of my colleagues on the Agriculture Committee as to, well, what has Duplin and Wayne County sent to the General Assembly now with this profound announcement that food doesn't come from the grocery store? But that is elementary. And I often ask groups, and I might ask this group here today, how long has it been, Mitch, since you seriously wondered whether you were going to have some food to eat tomorrow or not? And that will highlight how we've taken our food for granted.
Yeah, and that's certainly not true in many parts of the world. They are thinking about those questions every day here in the U.S. and in North Carolina. We don't have to think about it because the food is so plentiful, isn't it?
And economical and safe, which are very important things. So as a springboard from that first of all, that somebody's producing this food and fiber for us to have our prosperous ways of life, then we need to understand the role that government and regulations play today. There are some groups out there very well intended, but they do not understand the modern day agriculture procedures that we have. And their plows and combines and work boots turn out to be their pens and pencils and keyboards 1,000 miles from where the farms really are. And so we need a good process to re-enthrone the idea that food is the most important energy that we produce in this nation.
We are chatting with State Representative Jimmy Dixon. He is a farmer in Duplin and Wayne counties, as he mentions. He also chairs the State House Agriculture Committee. What are some of the biggest challenges that you see day to day in the General Assembly when it comes to agriculture? Does it have to deal with people just not understanding or remembering that the food has to come from the farmers?
We have probably the most supportive agricultural General Assembly in many decades in Raleigh now. And so many of my colleagues understand exactly what I'm talking about here. One of the things, Mitch, that we face in non-urban North Carolina is the fact that the population shifts in our population every census diminishes our ability for representation in the General Assembly. For example, in the last census, east of 95, we lost 7 seats in the House. That is something that we need to give serious attention to, because as we do become more urban, as we lose because of population shifts, our ability to represent with a vote the conditions of non-urban North Carolina, that is a serious, serious thing. So we have got to educate our urban friends as to the importance of agriculture today, so that we will have friendly voices and friendly votes to give agriculture properly measured priority as we go forward.
You mentioned that this is one of the more agriculture-friendly General Assemblies in a long time. Does that mean that there has been some success in getting these urban legislators to realize how important agriculture is?
Yes. Under the leadership of Senator Brent Jackson in our first session, we formed for the first time ever under Speaker Tillis and President Pro Tem Phil Berger an agriculture and rural caucus for the first time. And that's where legislators from across the state, you don't have to be in non-urban, you can be from anywhere, can join that caucus. And we talk about those issues that are critical for the production of food and fiber in a safe and economical way for the citizens of North Carolina and for the world as far as that goes.
I'm guessing the Agricultural and Rural Caucus used to be the entire General Assembly years ago. Now you have your own caucus. In the brief time that we have left, if there's one particular thing about agriculture that you suspect our listeners don't know that they should know, what would that be?
The degree to which government changing the goal line can affect us drastically, and especially the federal government. We recently, I think, have survived what was called the Waters of the United States, which was a critical piece of federal legislation that, if passed in its and in the form that it was presented, states could do nothing about it. The Clean Power Plan also has a drastic effect on, for example, how would you retrofit a combine to capture all the dust when picking soybeans or corn? So the inordinate interference of the federal government in our processes that have been tried and proven are the number one danger facing the agriculture today.
State Representative Jimmy Dixon, Chairman of the State House Agriculture Committee. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And we'll have more on Carolina Journal Radio in just a moment.
If you love freedom, we've got great news to share with you. Now you can find the latest news, views, and research from conservative groups all across the state, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com, one-stop shopping for North Carolina's freedom movement. At NorthCarolinaConservative.com, you'll find links to John Locke Foundation blogs on the day's news, CarolinaJournal.com reporting and quick takes, Carolina Journal radio interviews, TV interviews featuring CJ reporters and Locke Foundation analysts, plus opinion pieces and reports on higher education, all of that from the Pope Center for Higher Education Policy, commentary and polling data from the Civitas Institute, and news and views from the North Carolina Family Policy Council. That's right, all of that, all in one place. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. That's North Carolina, spelled out, conservative.com. NorthCarolinaConservative.com. Log on today. Welcome back to Carolina Journal Radio. I'm Donna Martinez. North Carolina will spend more than $9 billion on public education over the next year. That is a huge piece of the new $23 billion general fund budget. Now, a good deal of that money will help pay for teacher salaries and benefits, vacation pensions, and more. After four consecutive years of raises for teachers, some folks are now turning their focus away from pay and toward quality and effectiveness. Dr. Terry Stoops is the John Locke Foundation's Vice President for Research. He's also the Director of Education Studies, has been following the budget and the research very closely. Terry, welcome back.
Thank you.
In general, what do we know about the relationship between teacher quality and student performance?
We know that of the school-based factors, that teacher quality is the most important factor in determining student achievement. But we know also that there are numerous other factors outside of the school that also play a major role. And that's the most important thing to remember here, is that even if we raise the quality of our teacher workforce, which would be very important and very critical in raising student achievement, there are lots of other factors that play a role. So most of those things are things that the government really can't do anything to change, but teacher quality may be one that they can.
And presumably outside the classroom, you're thinking about things like parents and home environment.
That's exactly right. Those factors that are very difficult to quantify, but we know that out there in some ways that are hard to quantify or even describe, they do play a role.
Inside the classroom, it's interesting because I think if you've been a parent or you've been a student, which we all have been, you know that at a school, instinctively, people just know which teachers are the really good ones, and I use that word in quotes, and in which you either want to have as your teacher or you want your child to be in that teacher's classroom. And a lot of times we focus on how much formal education that person has. Is that really the measuring stick, Terry, for the quality of a teacher?
It really isn't. And let's just say that, you know, after decades of research, huge collections of data and analysis, we still can't quantify those factors, those combination of factors that make a great teacher great. We have some sense of things that are more likely to predict that a teacher is going to be good than other things. So, for example, just because a teacher has a master's degree in education doesn't mean they're going to be a good teacher. In fact, the research again and again shows that master's degrees in education have little bearing on student achievement. There are other factors that may have more of a relationship to student achievement, but things like a graduate degree in education, certification status, those things don't tend to have the kind of effects on student achievement that other factors may have.
Aren't those the things that we actually pay more money for, though, at least at this point in time?
Well, that's true. First of all, every teacher has to be certified unless you're in a charter school. So certification is a given. But master's degrees is a very interesting case study because after decades of research that says that master's degrees don't matter, the Republicans said, you know what, Republicans in North Carolina, said, we're going to look at what the research says and we're going to pay teachers accordingly. And we are not going to provide additional pay for master's degrees in education. Now, most other states do. We're actually one of the few that don't. But I think this is one of the cases where Republican legislators looked at the research and said, we don't think that paying for master's degrees makes any difference. And so we're going to put the money in other areas that appear to make teachers better and help students learn.
Let's talk more about that then, because the question is, what should we be looking for when we're hiring teachers? So does it matter, Terry, whether someone has a degree in education or a degree in a specialized field like math or science?
Well, that certainly depends on the field. And let me just preface everything by saying it really depends on the teacher. So we're looking at general trends here, but you really want teachers that understand their subject matter. At the very basic level, you want to make sure that a math teacher truly understands how math works. A social studies teacher truly understands history and geography. And we may think to ourselves, well, shouldn't we take that for granted that these teachers know the basics of their subject matter? And that's not always the case. So at the very basic level, knowing that teachers and recognizing that teachers have to be masters of their subject matter is absolutely critical. And if we can see that those individuals, for example, that have a mastery in science or math or social studies that enter the classroom tend to perform better than those that just have taken their education courses and a couple survey courses in their subject matter here or there and enter the classroom thinking that they're going to be expert teachers.
Terry, it almost sounds like you're making an argument for those the hiring of people who are coming in from business and industry or some other field where they actually deal with the subject matter day in and day out.
I think there's a compelling case to be made, and Republicans have been making more of an effort here in North Carolina to make it easier for those individuals to enter the classroom. But a good example of how this works in real life is Teach for America. Teach for America teachers don't have education degrees, but they have degrees in subject matter fields. And research says that in North Carolina, Teach for America teachers perform better than any other teachers, regardless if they're trained in the UNC system or elsewhere. These are teachers that master their subject matter first and come from elite universities, typically, that make for the best teachers. And we've known this for several years, that Teach for America really pays off, and Republicans in North Carolina have increased funding to ensure that more Teach for America teachers enter the classroom.
You used an interesting phrase, elite schools. Does it matter what university or college that someone went to, or is it the degree they're receiving, whether it's education or some specialty field, or just their performance in school?
Their undergrad institution definitely plays a role. And if you can think about it this way, it's not the institution itself, but the quality of education that student receives. And one could argue also you're getting a higher quality student that are entering those institutions in the first place. But it is a good marker that a teacher is going to be better at their subject matter and perhaps perform better in the classroom. Now, it's not an absolute that they're going to be a better teacher, but we can see that teachers that graduate from some of our top-tier universities have a better grasp of the subject matter and therefore are better able to be high performers in the classroom.
Now, we have a lot of teacher education programs in North Carolina universities, right?
That's right.
So does that mean that we should be taking a much more serious look not only at the curriculum that they are providing, but at the quality of the student, quite frankly, that are entering the programs?
That's right. And we should also be looking for incentives for making sure that high performers enter those teacher education programs. We see Republicans, for example, are trying to get more math and science folks into the teaching profession. And one way to do that is to provide tuition supplements for those students when they are at a university to entice them to go into the teaching field, because that right now is our biggest area of need, math, science, and special education teachers. We need to ensure that the pipeline remains strong, and we got to make sure that that pipeline starts at our schools of education.
Is there any way to find out about the background of the teacher or to choose your child's teacher?
Well, in most cases, the background of the teacher is available on websites, but the best thing that any parent or grandparent can do is to ask questions.
We've been talking with Dr. Terry Stoops. He is the John Locke Foundation's Director of Education Studies, also the Vice President for Research. Thank you, Terry. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for the program this week. Thank you for listening. On behalf of my co-host, Mitch Kokai, I'm Donna Martinez. Hope you'll join us again next week for more Carolina Journal Radio.
Carolina Journal Radio is a program of the John Locke Foundation. To learn more about the John Locke Foundation, including donations that support programs like Carolina Journal Radio, send email to development@johnlocke.org or call 1-866-JLF-INFO. That's 1-866-553-4636.
Carolina Journal Radio is a co-production of the John Locke Foundation, North Carolina's free market think tank, and Carolina Broadcasting System, Incorporated. All opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of advertisers or the station. For more information about the show or other programs and services of the John Locke Foundation, visit johnlocke.org or call us toll-free at 866-JLF-INFO. We'd like to thank our wonderful radio affiliates across North Carolina and our sponsors. From all of us at Carolina Journal Radio, thank you for listening, and please join us again next week.